say what you will about the post-war era in Iraq, but there is a lot at stake in the Middle East for the U.S. administration.
The White House is trying to cling to any straw to hide their naked lying about what happened about the nuclear weapons of mass destruction in Iraq.
Some people are saying that Saddam Hussein was a weapon of mass destruction, and I said, well, that's fine, they can't find him either.
Privatizing industries in Iraq is going to have political ramifications that the current American administration in Iraq, I don't think, has fully thought through.
For about 15 minutes, he put his head in my lap in front of all the kids, and he cried. And he says, I can't be here anymore.
This is Pacifica's Peace Watch for Thursday, June 26, 2003. I'm Verna Avery Brown. Bomb and grenade ambushes and hostile fire killed two American soldiers and two Iraqi civilians today, signaling increased anti-American resistance in Iraq, despite U.S. claims of mopping up opposition. Two American soldiers also were apparently abducted. In the latest reported attack, a member of a U.S. Special Operations Force was killed and eight were injured this morning by hostile fire southwest of Baghdad, the U.S. military said, giving no further details. Iraqi scientist Mahdi Obeidi has handed over to the CIA what's been characterized as critical parts of a key piece of Iraqi nuclear technology, parts needed to develop a bomb program. CNN is reporting that Obeidi hid these parts along with detailed plans under a rose bush in his garden a dozen years ago under orders from Saddam Hussein's son, Qusay Hussein, and his then son-in-law, Hussein Kamel. Peace Watch spoke earlier today with former Iraqi nuclear scientist Imad Kaduri, who worked with the Iraqi Atomic Energy Commission from 1968 until 1998. We asked how significant this news was and what kind of access Mahdi Obeidi had to the inner circles of Iraq's weapons program.
Mahdi was, in fact, in charge of one of the processes or the methods of enriching uranium, which was using the centrifugal, and that was assignment was given to him in 1986-87. And he, in a sense, and his group separated from the main atomic weapon program, which was undergoing in the Atomic Energy Commission of Iraq. The control of that group was directly under Hussein Kamel, indeed. And they were so separate that even I, who was in charge of all the documentation of the nuclear weapon program, could not get or would not get the documents or reports that this particular group issued. They were completely insulated by Hussein Kamel. Now, I understood later that they had the assistance of some German scientists and engineers in setting up a sample centrifuge. And this is simply a machine that spins at very exact rotation, and with this they can manage to separate the isotopes of uranium. But for a complete workable solution, you would need hundreds of these machines, spinning machines, kilometers long of long process plants to extract what would be at that time useful for a bomb. This was developed in South Africa.
Mm-hmm.
But what Mahdi had was just a couple of them, and they were just playing around. So all this, these adjectives that are now being attached, trying to exaggerate or defined, they're not really that key, they're not key, they're not that critical. This is nothing to do actually with the atomic bomb, it's simply preparing the uranium.
Is this a smoking gun the administration was looking
for? No way. This is the point of what happened actually. In 1991, immediately after the war, and the inspectors were going to come to Iraq, there was a decision taken by Hussein Kamel, personally, I think himself, perhaps in consultation with Saddam, but Hussein Kamel was in charge of all of the weapons of mass destruction programs, chemical, biological, and nuclear. He took a decision that he knew that the nuclear weapon program completely stopped the first night of the bombing. So he took a decision to destroy whatever was available of biological and chemical material and the warheads that had some of them. And during 1991, it was carried out, and Iraq was free from weapons of mass destruction in 1991. And this is even what Blix is now grudgingly admitting. Now, he had the hope that once the inspection teams would finish their chores and responsibilities, that they would leave, and he might somehow resurrect some of these programs. Now, this is where this guy Mehdi comes in. While we and the main nuclear program and the chemical biological were had to sign several times orders, specific orders, to hand in all documents and materials relating to the programs on the penalty of death. The latest one was 1997.
Mm-hmm.
Somehow, this person, either willingly or unwillingly, hoping to a little bit of fame later, didn't hand them in. He should have, as the rest of us did. Five times we signed this declaration that we did have them.
Mm-hmm.
That we do have to hand them in.
But you have Mahdi, you know,
Obeidi
burying equipment under his rose garden bush.
Yes, and his documents. Now, either he has a special exemption from Hussein Kamel, which I doubt, or he did it just, as I said, for some posthumous little glare mm-hmm. in the publicity.
At any rate, whatever this is he has is not really any indication of any vast weapons of mass destruction that the Bush administration...
No, these are simply relics. Well, they're antiques of what we had in the 80s. I'm going to publish my book soon. I finished writing it. I'm now going to the publisher. I have documents and references of the nuclear weapon program much more serious than Mahdi's relic evidence.
The fact that these were parts and plans for Iraq to possibly build a nuclear bomb program in the future, as well as the fact that these plans were buried for over a decade, almost seems to discredit any claims that the Bush administration has made in the past that Iraq was already on its way to developing nuclear capabilities, does it not?
Oh, it does indeed. Bush is completely wrong on this, and Blair and the CIA and whoever mismanaged this information, whoever blinded the American public that there is a danger from Iraq, this is completely false. I've been saying this for the past 6-7 months, actually.
Imad Kaduri, on the other hand, the White House has said that this find proved that Iraq planned to develop nuclear weapons in the future, and so U.S. concerns were actually justified. What is your reaction to that?
The White House is trying to cling to any straw to hide their naked lying about what happened about the nuclear weapons of mass destruction in Iraq. Bush claimed himself a month ago in St. Petersburg that the two vans that they found is, for him, in his great mind, it's proof that there is WMD in Iraq. Blair also hinted that, yet these vans were simply to generate hydrogen for meteorological balloons for the artillery, and nobody is now talking about them anymore. Now they're trying to get anything to exaggerate, to say that this is a proof. Everybody knows Iraq had WMD programs in 1980. This relic that they found is simply another fact of that matter. And we've been saying since 1991, there has been no weapons of mass destruction in Iraq. All has been destroyed. And they just cannot accept that, the Americans and the British. And they have been fooling the people and saying that Iraq continues to have them. Of course, any country wants to defend itself. And if Iraq at 1991 thought it might rejuvenate these programs once the inspections and threats, well, this is the most he can say. He would be lying to say that there was any WMD in Iraq since 1991. But if there's intention, everybody has intentions. And the White House has even worse devilish intentions than what Iraq had in mind.
Why do you suppose Mahdi Obeidi, the Iraqi scientist who handed over these parts and plans to the CIA, has done this at this particular time?
Well, I think he just saved his butt. He's trying to get out of Iraq, and he did. He is really a second image of this Fadal Hamza, the other nuclear scientist who has been claiming for 8 years Iraq has nuclear weapons just around the corner, who is now in Baghdad for 3 months, and he hasn't found anything. Mahdi Shukr Ali is a spit image of this other liar.
Now that the Ba'ath regime is removed from power and U.S. forces are ruling Iraq, do you think many more former government officials and scientists such as Obeidi will come forward to offer assistance to the U.S. authority?
I mean, already they have been contacted in Iraq. One of the main major managers of the chemical weapon program a month ago in Los Angeles Times, he came out. He said, look, if I had anything, wouldn't I want to grasp $200,000 reward that the Americans are giving? The fact is, I have nothing. And the fact is, no other Iraqi scientist or military has any evidence of weapons of mass destruction in Iraq since 1991. That's why they are not going to the Americans and collecting their $200,000 rewards. That's why they couldn't come out even before the Americans went in to go outside and talk about it. There's nothing to talk about unless they want to lie. And then how can they prove what they're saying? This simply proves that there is nothing there. Nobody is coming out and saying, look, there are the weapons, simply because there is none.
Imad Kaduri, any final thoughts on your part?
I don't think there'll be any more surprises like this one, and I think Bush and Blair better take responsibility and step down for their lies.
Imad Kaduri worked with the Iraqi Atomic Energy Commission from 1968 until 1998. He left Iraq with his family in late 1998 and now lives outside of Toronto. A top U.S. official has criticized the U.S.'s reconstruction's effort in Iraq, asserting that too few resources have been allocated for the job at hand. That's according to the Washington Post. At the World Economic Forum last weekend, Paul Bremer, the U.S.-appointed administrator in Iraq, announced plans to create free trade zones in Iraq and to privatize utilities and public services. In his speech, Bremer said, quote, without the discipline of the market, state-owned enterprises not only failed to create value, they destroyed it. Markets allocate resources much more efficiently than politicians, end quote. Pete Moore, assistant professor of political science at the University of Miami, specializing in Middle Eastern politics, wrote a paper critiquing the policy of developing free trade entitled Conflict, Commerce, and Cooperation, how the U.S.'s effort to counter terrorism with trade in the Middle East threatens to backfire. He spoke with Peace Watch about what he termed the short-sighted agenda to rebuild stability in Iraq.
One thing that would be important is tackling the political aspects of free trade. That from the example of Jordan, which is the one country that's gone the farthest with the United States in these free trade efforts since 1993, since the signing of the Oslo Peace Accord, that we've seen a lot of problems with the free trade agreements, that in many cases they've backfired, they've engendered a great deal of public distrust, for instance, in Jordan. And a lot of this has to do with fact that the basic political conflicts in the region have yet to be really addressed, and that is in part the Palestinian-Israeli conflict, but also what exactly the U.S. vision for the Middle East is, whether or not democracy really will be pursued. And so I think there's a whole host of political issues that need to be tackled at least before or at the same time as the economic ones, and these went really unaddressed at the World Economic Forum.
In his speech, Paul Bremer, the U.S.-appointed administrator in Iraq at the World Economic Forum, he said, quote, without the discipline of the market, state-owned enterprises not only failed to create value, they destroyed it. Markets allocate resources much more efficiently than politicians, end quote. Are there some concrete references to demonstrate that having a free market economy automatically stabilizes the economy, in your opinion?
No. I mean, the track record from the developing world is decidedly mixed. Some countries have benefited in the long run from free trade and market reform, while others have not benefited at all and actually had a great deal of problems. And at the heart of this is an assumption by the administration and advocates of free trade that free traders, once borders are open for trade, that those in countries that are the targets of this, for instance, Jordan and Middle East countries, that these traders will transform their political environment, transform their social environment towards what Bremer argues is, you know, freer politics. But the reality is the assumption is wrong, that actually traders will utilize the resources already at hand, which in a country like Jordan in the Middle East is cheap labor and lax labor laws, to exploit these openings. And so I think that's the heart of the matter, and the idea that free trade alone will bring political stability and liberal politics is very controversial.
And with regard to Iraq and the restructuring and rebuilding of Iraq, there's such an effort and a strategy underway to privatize. Is that a good idea in your opinion?
Well, we have to also realize that the state-owned enterprises that Bremer talks about were put there for a political purpose, and that political purpose was to employ people to be loyal to the state, to be loyal to the regime, and that countries like Jordan and Iraq, they're all very similar, Egypt in this manner, built large state-owned enterprises to employ people, to provide access, to create a middle class, but to create a middle class that would be tied to the state. And so we have to understand that dismantling these organizations will also dismantle a great deal of the political legitimacy that allowed central authority to take place in a place like Iraq or Jordan. And so we have to understand that it's more than just economic stakes that are at hand, but also political stakes. And so privatizing industries in Iraq is going to have political ramifications that the current American administration in Iraq, I don't think, has fully thought through.
And what, in your opinion, would be a more strategic, more politically savvy way of going about restructuring and rebuilding Iraq?
I think the thing we need to focus on is political participation. I mean, the politics of economic reform are messy. There's a great deal of dislocation in the short term. And the evidence from the developing world suggests that the more political participation you have, the greater involvement from more sectors of the society, it makes it easier, or at least it makes the compromise, the political compromise that's necessary to make these difficult economic decisions, it makes achieving that compromise easier, and it makes such compromise more long-lasting. If these decisions are taken from a centralized political authority that's deemed to be controlled by the United States, then once the United States loses interest, pulls out, then those decisions, those compromises can be easily undone, and we're back to square one again. So I think that putting the political ahead of the economic, encouraging self-Iraqi rule, building the kinds of participatory institutions that can make these compromises ought to be at the top of the list.
Professor Moore, is there a special, unique type of consciousness or manner of doing business, perhaps nuances that are unique to the Arab world? In your paper, Conflict, Commerce, and Cooperation, How the U.S. Effort to Counterterrorism with Trade in the Middle East Threatens to Backfire, you introduced the paper by talking about an old joke about the business acumen of the Arabs. Can you share that joke with us?
Yeah, actually the joke kind of comes, my family originally was Arab American, so I had to listen to a lot of these kinds of stereotypes of Arabs among themselves growing up. But the joke goes like this, says, a teacher asks a Lebanese boy what 2 + 2 is, and the Lebanese boy answers, are you buying or selling? And the idea here is that Arabs self-identify, especially Arabs in the diaspora, but also Arabs in the Middle East, self-identify as businessmen, as one of their kind of cultural identities. There's an old quip that the Islam is the only religion founded by a successful businessman. Of course, the Prophet was a successful businessman in his day. And so kind of the issue here is that the Bush administration is betting a lot of political capital on that commercial spirit of the Arab world to reap the kinds of changes that it envisions. And on the other hand, there are serious political and historical reasons why the Arab private sector is not going to kind of grab the mantle of democracy, solve the Arab-Palestinian problem, and get rid of terror. And so we're kind of caught between this stereotype of Arabs being kind of almost inbred as businessmen, but also real political and historical problems and struggles that mean that that kind of role is not what we're going to see in the Arab world. There's going to have to be a lot more change politically in the region before that kind of role will be realized.
Mm-hmm. And what are you concerned might backfire with regard to the U.S. effort to counterterrorism with trade?
Well, already we've seen in Jordan that the whole effort for free trade, qualified industrial zones, a free trade agreement in Jordan, which is the one country that's gone furthest along this road, that the outcomes are, I would argue, quite negative. That the effort to harness trade to build deeper relations between Israelis and Jordanians has completely backfired. We have a thoroughgoing grassroots movement in Jordan to not purchase Israeli and American products. So one of the better strategies for countering terrorism is addressing political disputes, addressing the roots of political disputes. And in part, those political disputes in the Middle East are a great gap between the rulers in Middle Eastern countries and those that they govern. And the more that we pursue these kinds of trade regimes, absent any other kind of political reform, the more we're going to entrench that distinction, that division, that gap between everyday Arab middle class and professionals and their governments, really the problem.
Can you give us an example of how that might play out?
Take, for example, Jordan. In Jordan, we've seen almost a decade now of thoroughgoing qualified industrial zones that allow duty-free export to the United States from Jordan. We see figures touted by the administration that says, you know, Jordanian exports to the U.S. are way up. A lot of Jordanians are being employed by these zones. But the reality behind this is look at the people that are benefiting from these zones. The people that are benefiting are not, by and large, Jordanian workers, because half of the workers are actually Asians imported by the companies that run these textile firms. And also the people that manage the zones are the ones that are benefiting, individuals tied to the monarchy, tied to the regime for a long time. And these are the ones that are reaping the reward, not necessarily new entrepreneurs, not new sectors of Jordanian society, and certainly not workers. And what this is doing is that the same old people are benefiting, the same groups of entrepreneurs and cronies, if you will, connected to the regime are the ones that are benefiting from these kinds of reforms. This kind of trade without other types of reform is certainly not going to bring greater political participation to Jordan. And in fact, in the very period that we've seen greater free trade in Jordan, political participation has been curbed in Jordan. There's been a crackdown on dissident groups and a crackdown by the government on opposition groups. And so the outcome has been exactly opposite from what the administration has been calling for.
Pete Moore, assistant professor of political science at the University of Miami, specializing in Middle Eastern politics. Well, during the Take Back America conference earlier this month in Washington, D.C., where over 2,000 progressive activists and leaders gathered for an event designed to energize participants, U.S. Congressman Dennis Kucinich of Ohio redefined the phrase weapons of mass destruction. In his presidential candidacy speech, he challenged the Bush administration's fraudulent foreign policy by threatening to expose the lies behind the reasons for going to war in Iraq.
I just came back from the Congress of the United States, where just before I left for this speech, I put in the well of the House a piece of legislation. Matter of fact, this is what the clerk gave me, House Resolution 260. This resolution provides for a resolution of inquiry, which is a process which demands the administration produce its evidence about what they said they had, weapons of mass destruction. Now is the time. Now is the time. Where are the weapons of mass destruction? We're going to find out. They're going to tell the truth. I am proud to have led 126 Democrats who voted against the Iraq resolution. And we've been saying it all along, as you've been saying it all along. And let this be a moment of truth-telling for America that Iraq had no, there was no connection between Iraq and 9/11. There was no connection between Iraq, 9/11, and Al-Qaeda. There was no connection between Iraq and the anthrax attack on this country. And Iraq did not have those weapons of mass destruction. But this administration went in anyway and created a pretext for war. And this war was wrong. This war was fraudulent. And we must expose this administration. Yesterday, I had the opportunity to be on CNN, and Aaron Brown said, well, some people are saying that Saddam Hussein was a weapon of mass destruction. And I said, well, that's fine. They can't find him either. But, you know, as Leo mentioned, I come from the city. I was a child of the city. I understood, growing up as the oldest of the family of seven, that, as Langston Hughes once put it, life for me ain't been no crystal stair. And I remember where I came from. And I think that I can be of help to this administration in its effort to find weapons of mass destruction because, Mr. President, they're here at home. Poverty is a weapon of mass destruction. And homelessness is a weapon of mass destruction. And joblessness is a weapon of mass destruction. And poor health care is a weapon of mass destruction. And when a government lies to its people, that is a weapon of mass destruction. Now, there have been those in our Democratic caucus who have been well-meaning, and they were saying last year, you know, we don't think the president's telling the truth. But we think that we need to take this war off the table. That's what they said. Take the war off the table and let's talk about all the other issues which we're so good talking about. And at that moment, in my capacity then as chair and now co-chair with Barbara Lee of the Progressive Caucus, I said in those meetings, if we say we're going to take this war off the table. We're kidding ourselves, because this administration only wants to talk about a war. They don't want to talk about Enron. They don't want to talk about fraud against stockholders. They don't want to talk about the corruption of Wall Street. They don't want to talk about all the people out of work. They don't want to talk about all the people without health care. They don't want to talk about our children going to schools that are falling apart. They don't want to talk about any of those things. All they want to talk about is war. And so that's all they talked about. And as a result, because our leadership wasn't successful enough in challenging them and meeting them toe-to-toe on the issue of war, we lost the chance to take back the Congress. And let me tell you what's going to be different in this election. I'm going to challenge this administration step-to-step, toe-to-toe on all of their fraudulent foreign policies that lead to war, and then we're going to be able to get to that domestic agenda, and we will win the domestic agenda by triumphing over them on the foreign policy agenda and exposing their march to war, exposing the fraudulent basis for war, exposing what they've done to build up a military budget, exposing what they've done to cause fear in our society, exposing what they've done to depress our economy. That's the way we're going to win this election, challenge this administration, and I am prepared to do it.
U.S. Congressman, presidential hopeful Dennis Kucinich of Ohio, addressing the Take Back America conference on June 14th, 15th, and 16th in Washington, D.C. Well, the words true blue take on a new meaning in this political satire by the Christmas coup comedy players of Pacifica Stations, KPFT of Houston, and WBAI of New York.
We take you now live to a scaffold outside the window of the Oval Office, where Vice President Dick Cheney and National Security Advisor Condoleezza Rice, wearing coveralls and paintbrushes in their hand, are meeting with the President of the United States, George W. Bush.
Connie, Dick, want to thank you for helping me paint the White House blue.
Well, it's a good idea, Mr. President.
Don't rock the scaffold, Dick.
Well, you're getting paint on my coveralls, Condi.
I like to paint. It's relaxing.
Yeah.
Okay? Churchill painted. Red Skelton painted. He painted clowns.
Yeah.
Yes, he did. It's good to relax, Mr. President.
Now you're rocking the scaffold, Condi.
You're rocking the scaffold, Dick.
They say I failed to protect the artifacts. Yeah. Went to war based on lies. Showboated on the Abe Lincoln.
Yeah.
And that mass graves we found are 12 years old. They're still mass graves, aren't they?
Yeah.
Doesn't matter if they're
1,000
years old.
That's right, they're
mass graves.
Mm-hmm.
20,000 years old, they're mass graves.
They are.
And we found them.
We did.
That's why I decided to show my critics what's what and paint the White House blue.
Oh, that's a great...
Blue. A blue White House is like a blue-white diamond, Mr. President.
It's for true blue Americans, Connie. You understand that?
Yes.
You understand that, Dick?
Yes.
Yeah, I got it.
Those that don't carp about our... Don't carp. I'm having a hard time. I got
carp.
A pretzel on my throat.
Fish.
Those that don't carp about us not finding any weapons of mass destruction,
yes.
Let me tell
yes.
you about that.
Right.
Okay?
Yes.
It's for true blue Americans.
True blue.
The ones that don't carp.
Don't carp.
About us
carp's
not finding weapons of mass destruction
carp.
In 25 million year old graves.
That's it. Carp's a fish, not a thing to do.
That's right.
Okay. Those who love war.
Yes. Bombs bursting in air, Mr.
Beautiful.
President.
I love that.
Yeah.
Ah, that's great.
Yeah.
By the way, what is that supposed to mean, Dick?
Well, it's from the national anthem, Mr. President.
We have smart bombs now, Dick. Bombs don't burst in the air anymore.
Well.
Bombs burst exactly where we want them to drop and explode.
Yes, Mr. President, they do.
You know, those bunker buster bombs didn't burst in the air, Mr. President.
That's right.
No.
They burst in the bunker, okay, Connie?
Yes.
All right?
Yes.
Bam! We blew up Saddam, okay?
Yes.
I hope we blew him up.
Mm.
He died near those mass graves that were found that were 25 million years old that he's responsible for.
Yes, he did.
And for those who believe we did, that we did get Saddam Hussein, I'm painting the White House blue.
The Christmas coup comedy players of Pacifica Station, KPFT of Houston, and WBAI of New York. You're listening to Pacifica's Peace Watch. I'm Verna Avery Brown. We'll be back in a moment.